Session number 9427.
Mr. Charlesworth, room 3.
Well, off we went down to the village. And as we went through the gates of the village, just inside the gate there was a well, a watering place, as you might say, and I saw two or three of our chaps stood around there, so I went over to them and said how glad I was to see them. And these Spaniards, they just laughed and went off down into the village. The Spaniards who brought me. And that was it.
Had they spoken to you in English or Spanish?
No, Spanish, only Spanish, and I didn't speak a lot of Spanish. But I wasn't going to let on, I didn't know, as I say, I didn't know, up to that moment, I didn't know whether the enemy or who they were. So I wasn't going to give much away if I could help it.
Were you still in Four Company?
No, that had long gone after Grand. There was none left of it after Grand anyway. No, it wasn't, we weren't in company so much then. The battalion was depleted. It was just a group of men, that's all, at that time. I mean, on the first day at Brunetti, we lost. At that particular place was Villanueva de la Cañada, the village name. And we lost no end of men there. George Brown was killed there. No end were killed there or wounded. And we were just a large group of men after that, rather than companies and platoons and battalion, you know.
Can you describe how the casualties occurred?
Well, it's difficult to say, really, you know. I mean, in a battle like that, people get shot here, people get shot there, you know. It's all rifle fire or machine gun fire. It wasn't anything else. But, I mean, you can't just say how it all happened, because people get hit differently, don't they? You know, you get, for instance, I said that the battalion was on this... on this ridge, well, several were hit up there while they were actually in positions that were not really exposed to the enemy, as you might say, you know. But the enemy obviously could see them. They were up in the church tower, that's where they were. They got a machine gun up in the church tower and they could see for miles from up there. And that's where most of the casualties came from during the day. And then, of course, I think during that little shooting match at night after dark there, I think quite a few got hit there. There were a lot of civilians killed in that because the fascists came out, you know, driving civilians in front of them.
Did you see that?
No, I was in this dark. It was pitch black, you know, it was dark. And they didn't come up the road, I do know that. They came out on the side of the road, you see, and when they came up against our blokes on this ridge, that's when the firing started, you see. And there was firing both ways and civilians were in the middle. And so I say, the following morning when we went up the road, there was dozens of them lying there dead. Civilians and fascists, and some of ours as well, like.
So you saw the civilian dead?
Oh, yeah.
About how many?
I should think 12, 15 civilians. There was others as well, like, soldiers, you know, military besides.
What sexes were the civilians?
Both sexes. Elderly. All elderly.
So did you get any shots away?
Any?
Did you fire any rounds?
No. No, I had nothing to fire at. I was in this dark. I never saw anything. Never saw a thing. I didn't. You know, during the hours of daylight, I'd gone down this dike trying to get this water. And as I say, when I got to this bend, I immediately came under fire. So I went back a few yards round the bend, and I came under fire again. So I was about 20 yards of dike, and I was safe in that. If I moved either way, I came under fire. And I was still there, as I said, when it got dark, you know, dusk. And then this hullabaloo went on, and I couldn't see anything going on. I could only hear the firing, and I never saw anybody, either up and down the road. Never.
What kind of a weapon did you have?
A rifle.
Made where?
Well, we called them Mexicanskis. But we all knew damn well they were Russian. You know, they were Russian rifles. Yeah.
Was it in good condition?
Oh, they were brand new. Well, it was brand new when it was issued to me. Like, yes, it was in good condition.
What did you think to Fred Kirtman?
He was a nice enough fella, but you had to do as he said. He was firm, very firm. But once you got to know him, he was a very nice fella. And I did get to know him very well, both in Spain and since Spain. And
Was he a disciplinarian?
he was very strict, very strict. Up to a point, up to a point. If it had to do with safety, he was very, very strict indeed. But providing you were getting on with what you're supposed to do and doing it in a reasonable manner, he was quite happy.
Was he popular?
I think so. I think so. Well, it's difficult to say until exactly when, but during the first few months of 1937, at least, he was very popular. And then I think he was still popular amongst the men, but I think he wasn't so popular with the I don't know how to put this, the organisation behind the British Battalion. I think he fell out, they fell out with him, or he fell out with them or something, and he was brought back to England.
The organisation in Britain or in Spain?
Well, I don't really know. I think it'd be in Britain, because there wasn't, as far as I know, there wasn't an organisation in Spain, you know, a British organisation in Spain, so I've got a feeling it'd be the Communist Party in this country myself, because for some reason or other, and this has always been a mystery to me, Fred Courtman, of course, was involved in the Invergordon Mutiny. As was Sam Wilde. And I always took him to be he wasn't what you call a political animal. And I never took him to be a religious animal either. Yet it appears that the powers that be over here have brought him back, because he'd gone all religious.
Whilst he was in Spain?
Yeah. How true it is, I don't know, but I do know that he became a very, very devout Roman Catholic. And at Loughborough, I spoke with him a lot at Loughborough, and he was a very religious-minded man.
That was in 1977?
Yeah.
Was his interest in religion evident to you whilst you were in Spain?
Never. Never. I never heard him speak of politics or of religion in Spain. Never.
Was it evident to you in Spain that he had some dispute with the organisers of the International Brigade?
No, it wasn't evident to me. It was only what I heard afterwards. But I know he suddenly disappeared from the scene in Spain, and that was it. And Sam Wilde took his place. They were best of friends, really, because, as I said, they'd both been involved in the Invergordon Mutiny. And Sam Wilde, of course, wasn't a disciplinarian at all. He was a happy-go-lucky kind of fellow, you know, and he'd go and everybody had to follow him. He'd always be at the front, Sam. I liked Sam, he was a good...
Was he more political than Fred Courtman?
Well, he was a very active Labour Party man. He was right up to the time he died, as a matter of fact.
How did Labour people and Communist people get on with each other in the International Brigade?
Well, as I said, there was a political commissar. The battalion had a political commissar, but there were no politics discussed as such, you know. There were no lectures on politics or anything like that. So whether you were Communist, Labour, or non-political, it didn't matter at all. You all got on just the same. You know, if you wanted to talk politics, you talked politics. If you wanted to talk about anything else, you talked about anything else, and that was it. Sam Wilde, this is in a joking sense, really. After Sam Wilde was wounded, badly wounded, on the first day at Arama, he had 5 bullets in his side. And after he came out of hospital, he was still in a weak condition. And Fred Courtman was a battalion commander then. So Fred gave him the job of looking after a little ammunition dump, perhaps half a mile behind the front line, down the side of a hill. And to get to the British battalion from this earth road, You had to go along a path, drop down into a ravine, then up some steps at the other side. And Sam Wild's ammunition dump was just at the bottom of those steps. So anyone going to the battalion had to pass him, or anyone coming from the battalion had to pass him. And of course, I used to go down very frequently. I used to walk down into the village to get the mail for the battalion. So I always used to stop and have a chat with Sam Wild, because it was, some days I was probably the only person he ever saw, you know. And I always used to stop and have a talk with him, and he always used to be on to me about the Labour Party. I always remember that.
What did he used to say about the Labour Party?
For some reason or other, he seemed to think I belonged to the Independent Labour Party, and he used to chide me about it, you know. And it went on for days and days before I got it through to him that it was the Labour Party I belonged to, not the Independent Labour Party. And of course, we're always good pals, Sam and me.
Who was the political commissar?
It changed very often. Dave Springall was the first one. And after that, we had a fella called Aitken, Bob Williams. Oh, it changed. There were so many of them, you know. Wally Tapsell, he was a leading communist. Bob Cooney. Bob Cooney, I think, was one of the last ones.
Peter Kerrigan?
Peter Kerrigan, yes. But not so much the battalion. I don't think he was ever the battalion commissar. I think he was the commissar down in Albacete. He was one of the British leading lights out there, as you might say. It was probably his reports back to London that got Fred Courtman withdrawn. I wouldn't like to say yes or no, but I know that he was a leading Communist Party member, has been all his life, most of his life. And he was at Albacete, which was the base, so I would think he was a commissar there, so I would think that he would be reporting to London. I don't know, you know, what his thoughts on this and thoughts on that were. I don't know for sure, but that's what I would think.
Did you sense any problem between Fred Courtman and Peter Kerrigan?
Well, as I said, Peter Kerrigan, very rare we saw him. He was at Albacete, we were up in the front. He did come up occasionally, I'd have seen him occasionally, but no, I wouldn't have sensed anything between them.
How do you think the political commissar system worked? Do you think it was a good system?
It didn't really matter one way or the other, I don't think. I don't think it mattered one way or the other. It had its little benefits, insofar as if you got a complaint, you knew where to go with it. You know, a complaint against things in general, you know, against military life, you knew where to go with it. But otherwise, I don't think it mattered much at all. For instance, at Harama, the battalion headquarters was right there, right in the front line, not 5 yards from it, from the line itself. It was in just at the end of a communication trench. That communication trench was, 100 yards long. And at the other end of the communication trench was Jock Cunningham. And at that particular time, he was acting as a liaison for the brigade. He was acting as liaison with the British battalion. Now, I happened to be going down to the village for the mail one day, and we'd had a stinking lousy meal. Beans, and they were the carbanthas they were called, and they were terrible. I don't know whether it was the cooking of them or the fact that they were off, you know. Anyway, I stopped at Jock Cunningham's place, and I told him, I said, you're going to have a bit of trouble on your hands up there if you keep dishing more food up like that. And he went up in there and veered hell with me. Well, I thought the world had come to an end, you know. Oh, I'll never mention out like that to you again, mate. I hadn't said it to... I was putting it, you know, just in a kindly kind of way. That the food was bad and the bloke didn't like it. And he went up in the air about it.
What exactly did he say?
Well, you know, don't say things like that, or you'll be for it. Things like, you know, threatening me kind of thing. Well, I took them as threats, and I was, well, I wasn't afraid of them, but I did take a little bit of notice of what he said, you know, because he was a very stern fellow, Jock Cunningham was, very strict, very stern. I had another occasion with him at Brunetti, as a matter of fact.
What happened then?
Pardon?
What happened then?
Well, the battalion was at its furthermost point of advance at a place known as Mosquito Ridge. At least, it's the Mosquito Ridge that I know as Mosquito Ridge, not the Mosquito Ridge you'll see marked on the maps in all the books, because they've got it on the wrong side of the road on the maps. Anyway, it doesn't really matter that. As I said, the battalion was up there at this furthermost point of advance. And I was going down to fetch the mail from the river, which was, what, a mile and a half back. I'd got to come down the hillside, across a dry river bed, up a slight rise to a place where there was a square of trenches on a piece of high ground, and drop down to the road and follow it down to the river. Well, Jock Cunningham had a little dugout in this square of trenches, and again he was liaising for the brigade, you see. And as I was going by, I heard a shout from the dugout. And I just popped my head in and said, I'm just going down the river for the mail. Straight away, bawler, never mind the mail, come here. I want you to take a message. You know, and it was as if it was God himself speaking, as you might say, you know. And, the brigade was at the riverbank. I was going there for the mails. It meant nothing to me. It was nothing to me to take a message. It was the same place I was going to for the mail. So I didn't argue about it, but, I never seemed to get on well with him. Anyway, I went down, got the mail, and the cookhouse wagon was there as well at the same time, so I got a couple of great big dixies of hot grub, you know, soup, taters, meat, and all the what you call it, all mixed up in these dixies. So off we went up with these. I delivered this message to brigade, and as I say, it's only 50 yards away from the narrow little river, like, and I stood outside the little dugout, you know, expecting a reply, and I'd been there, 30 seconds, and the commanding officer came out, and he was in a, I don't know what happened, really. He was fuming away, get away from here, get away from here, get away from here, you'll have us bombed, you know, and of course, they had been bombed a couple of times, you see. And so I just went about 50 yards away and sat under a tree. And I waited there half an hour. There was nobody bothered about a reply. So I went, and as I said, I'd got my letters then. But by the time I'd come back from under this tree, the grub wagon was there. So I picked these couple of dixies up, you see, to take up. And I just called in at Jock Cunningham's to tell him I'd had no reply, like. And off I went with these dixies. Well, I walked from this square of trenches down into the dry river bed. Then I followed that along. And I came to a group of Yanks, 20 or 30 of them, I suppose. And just where they were, there was a water pipe across this dried up river bed with a bullet hole in it and water all spurting out. And these Yanks begged me to let them have some food, and I wouldn't let them have any, because it was to the battalion. Well, what was left of the battalion, you know. So I walked past them, and they never said anything, other than begging for the food, like. And I walked on, another 100 yards, and then I turned up to go up the hillside. And just at that particular place, it was fairly longish grass, and an odd tree here and there, and I'd gone, 30 yards, and all at once were bullets flying all around. So the first thing I did, I dropped down, put the cans down, and darted behind a thick tree. And there was bullets splurting there for half an hour. They got their eye on me from somewhere. Anyway, it died down, and I waited a long while longer. Then I crawled back, picked my dixies up, worked my way back to the dried-up riverbed, and went back. And when I got back to these rounds, they told me I'd been wandering round in no man's land with those dixies. Once I'd passed then, I was in no man's land. It was fantastic, really. I mean, I had to laugh about it afterwards, but it was no joke at the time.
Where was this?
Hmm?
Where was this?
This was, the British battalion was, it was a, what they call a Bernetti offensive, but the British battalion was on Mosquito Crest. And I took the group up, I went back another quarter of a mile before I found the proper ravine that led up to them. And when I got up there with the grub and the mail, it was the first grub they'd had for 2 days, that was, and Sam Wilde was lying in on a stretcher down in the bottom of the ravine, waiting to nightfall to be carried down.
Who was the commanding officer who told you to get away? Who was the commanding officer?
Copic. C-O-P-I-C. Or C-O-P-I-C, which was it? I can't remember which. Copics.
Did anything else happen to you at Brunetti which we should mention?
Yeah, well, after we'd left, it's really a long story. We went up the road, across the river, went up the road when we were advancing, and we went into a field where we got shelled. This was a battalion as a whole, what was left of it. We left that field and went up the road again and then got in the dike at the side of the road. Charlie Goodfellow was killed there. He was hit by top of his head was chopped off by a shell splinter.
Did you see that?
Yeah, it wasn't 5 yards away from me. Yeah, and another lad was killed. They had a little ammunition dump set it on fire with a shell, and two or three of the lads from the anti-tank gun lot. They were dragging all these boxes away, and one of them exploded and killed one of the blokes. That was, a few yards the other side of us. And then we went up to this square trenches, and then advanced along slight downhill to a little shallow road in along just an earth track. That's a cart track it was really. And we were the battalion was lined up along there with the enemy somewhere in the bottom or slightly up the other side, about 300-400 yards away. I couldn't see them, and it was while we were there, I don't know whether it was a bullet or a stone chip knocked up by a bullet caught me across the nose, and little bits went into my eye. I didn't know at the time what it was. I just felt the burning pain, across my nose, and my eye hurting as if it had got bits dust in it, And I rubbed it, and it didn't seem bad. There was no blood. Anyway, 2 days later, I couldn't open it. It just gone solid, with pus and the like. So I had to go into hospital with it, and the doctor I saw, he was a Spaniard. He was an eye specialist, and he'd been trained at Cambridge in England, so he spoke perfect English. And he operated on it 5 times to cut all these little, they were like all little cysts on right on the edge of the eyebrow, and he kept cutting away at them, and eventually they cleared up, and he told me I needed glasses, and he checked, testing my eyes for glasses like. He said, I'll test them, he said, but you'll never get any. He told me point blank, I didn't expect getting any. Anyway, I went back to the battalion, and now here's another incident. The truck took me to the river bank, and it dropped me there. And I was the only one left on the truck. I was the only one to get off there. And the one to soul inside anyway. So I thought, well, the battalion's probably back up Mosquito Crest way. So I set off up the road, and it went up from the river quite steeply for half a mile or so. And then it not so steeply for another half a mile to three quarters of a mile. And then that was the crest, as you might say. And just on the right of the road, a matter of 50 yards, were this square of trenches on a little bit of higher ground. Well, I just walked openly up the road, got level with this square of trenches, and I could see in between the road and the square of trenches a fire with one of these big army frying pans on it, So I thought, I'm all right for a bit of grub here. So I set off from the road towards this frying pan, And I'd got almost to the frying pan when bullets started splattering all around my feet. And they were coming from very close. I could hear, you know, the sound of the firing was so loud, intense. So, without a second thought, I just about turned and straight back into the dike at the side of the road. And these bullets still kept coming onto the dike, top of the dike, you know, splattering all around. And I crawled down the dike, what, 300 yards. And then I went behind a higher dike that led into a field, and I was there for a while. The bullets kept coming, so I went back onto the other dike and crawled down until I got into dead ground where the road steamed to go down the hill. And then, of course, they couldn't see me then, and they couldn't, the firing stopped. Evidently, while I'd been in hospital, the battalions had all come back, and the enemy had occupied these positions, and I'd been within 20 yards of them, must have been 20 yards of them. Oh dear. And the battalion, I went back down to the river and I did find out where the battalion was, and they were in a little hollow just a little way along the river. And I joined them there, and of course they were on the point of being withdrawn then. The offensive had finished. And we marched out from there.
Which was the worst, Brunetti or Jarama?
Oh, Jarama. Jarama was the worst, by far. It was by far the worst of any of the battles, by far, because of the fact that it was the first battle. Most men had never been in battle before,